Welcome. It's lovely to see each of you. I can't tell you how pleased I am that our three distinguished colleagues have stayed for several extra days. They were all here to speak at a major conference at what we call the Riverside Campus of the University of Alberta in Edmonton. It's that very small campus up north. At a conference largely planned by the Political Science Department under the title The Dignity of Difference, Beyond the Clash of Civilizations and the End of History. I have had the pleasure of talking with each of them a little bit, and I hope to have more of that pleasure. We are privileged to have you. And I would like to ask my good colleague and friend, Ibrahim Aburabi, who many of you have had the privilege of getting to know a little bit and listen to introduce our colleagues. The process here is going to be, for the next hour and 10 minutes or so, we will be engaged by Professor Hanafi, and then there will be a brief lunch, a little bit to eat, downstairs by C014. And following that, we will go into 014 and continue our evening's learning. So, Professor Aburabi.
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to introduce our speakers here for this afternoon. The first one is going to be Professor Hassan Hanafi of Qatar University. I want to be brief in my introduction. In 1969, a major book was published in the English language about the problems of modern Islam and the Arab world by the title of Arabic Thought in the Liberal Age, written by the British Lebanese author Albert Hourani. Oxford University Press published that. And Albert Hourani in that book talks about a number of issues that beset modern Islam from the 19th century on, such as stagnation and reform, revivalism, fundamentalism, and all of the issues that we still grapple with as Arabs and Muslims in the world in the 21st century. Professor Hassan Hanafi has spent most of his life grappling with the same issues of stagnation and revivalism in modern Arabic and Islamic thought. And to do that, he went to France to study in 1956, where he spent 10 years studying Islamic philosophy as well as French and European philosophy. After 10 years, he went back to Cairo, where he had originated from, and he began to teach at Cairo University at the Faculty of Arts in the Department of Philosophy. And I had the pleasure of being his student at one time when I was a Fulbright scholar in Cairo like 15 years ago. And I saw how many students came from different parts of the Muslim world, as far as Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, to study with him in Cairo, at the University of Cairo. Professor Hassan Hanafi has published in an extensive way in both Islamic and Western philosophy. In addition to doing translations from French and English into Arabic, he has written in a creative way about the modern problems of Islam and the Muslim world, the modern issues that face Egypt and other Arab and Muslim countries, especially since the denationalization of Egypt since 1970 until the present time. Recently, he has published a number of major books in the Arabic language, from self-annihilation to presence or ontological presence. He has published also about traditional Islamic reasoning and modern Western rationalism. He has published a major book as well about the Indian South Asian philosopher who is known to be the founder of modern Pakistan, Allama Iqbal. If you go to Lahore, Pakistan nowadays, there is the Major Iqbal Academy that is very much sponsored by the Pakistani government. Iqbal is a big name for Muslims in South Asia, especially in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Kashmir, in addition to the Arab world. Our second speaker is going to be Professor Mustafa Abu Swai, who is a Palestinian scholar who's come from Jerusalem, especially from Al-Quds University, That's a private or government Palestinian university that was established 15, 20 years ago. And Mustafa and I have known each other for the past 29 years or 30 years because we studied together in Palestine at the time. And Mustafa has a degree in Islamic philosophy from Bolshan University. He taught in different Islamic universities, especially at the Islamic University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And he has been a Fulbright scholar in the USA. He's written a lot on classical Islamic philosophy, on issues of interfaith dialogue, on Jewish-Muslim coexistence, on Zionism and Islam, and Zionism and the Arabs. And today he's going to talk, of course, primarily about the Islamic movement in Palestine that is known in the press as Hamas. But of course, the Islamic movement in Palestine is much larger than Hamas. Whereas Professor Hassan Hanafi will talk about the Islamic movement in Egypt and the Arab world. Our third speaker is a well-known publisher from England, Dr. Roger Van Zwanberg, who is the publisher and the founder of Pluto Press. Pluto is a leftist press that has published a number of books on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Nowadays, he's publishing books on Islam. He's published books on political economy, the food crisis in the world, especially in Africa, ecology, American bases around the world, and so on and so forth. And we have asked Roger to speak about the way political Islam has been portrayed in the West, especially in the presses, especially in his own press, Pluto Press. And so we will ask Professor Hassan Hanafi to begin his talk, and David knows all the, time-wise, how much time he has to speak. So you have basically Arbeen Dakika. Badim Rahis al-Asli.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, David and Ibrahim, for the nice introduction. Indeed, I know Canada when I was teaching at Temple University in Philadelphia 40 years ago. I crossed Canada from east to west by Greyhound bus 2-3 times from Montreal till Vancouver in order to discover the new world and so on, as well as I did with USA. Anyhow, then I am familiar with you, and I hope that after my talk, I will be giving you something to reflect upon. Philosophers don't give knowledge, but they give questions, and in order that you can find your answers alone. The title is The Future of Political Islam and the West. That means the other for us. But the subtitle is Islamic movement in the Arab world with a focus on Egypt. Then Islamic, political Islam has two relevance. One, the relevance of political Islam in the West, and the other time is the relevance of political Islam in the East, that means in the Arab world and in Egypt. I cannot dissociate one from the other, but anyhow, I will try to give you some data concerning the topic. It is very difficult to make an opposition between two entities, the West and Islam. Because what does the West mean? For us who are specialists in the West, there are several Wests. The capitalistic West, the liberal West, the socialist West, the popular West, the romantic West, what West exactly? And what in the West? Is it France? Is it Germany? Is it Italy? Is it Spain? Is it, where the West? Or is it USA? Is it Canada? What is the difference between West and Europe and so on? Then the West, it is so ambiguous. But we leave it as it is. And political Islam, what does that mean? Is this the violent Islam, the angry Islam, the rejectionist Islam, the underground Islam, or the more liberal Islam, capable of dialogue, the more rational Islam, the more humanistic Islam. I am activist in the political Islam, but from the second type, from the liberal who would like to make a dialogue, attacked by the angry Islam and also attacked by the West. Then the political Islam is also very ambiguous, very vague, but we leave it as it is. That means because it became a category, there are a lot of books which has been written on this. I will not give you data, because the data exists in the books, but I will try to analyze what exists, the facts, what you are seeing every day, what you are watching in the mass media. Being a phenomenologist, then I will try also to analyze living experiences of mine and of yours since I am in the arena since 50 years. I will not attack the political Islam nor defend the political Islam. I will not justify the political Islam. I will not reject the political. I will not make any value judgment on the political Islam. But I will describe it as a phenomenologist. Phenomenology is to return back to things as they are. And then it is up to you to make your own judgment. There is a danger of generalizing the judgments. Generalizing on a very complex phenomenon. And in the Arab world, where in the Arab world? Every Arab country has its own specific history. Egypt is not Sudan, is not Libya, is not North Africa, is not Iraq, is not Syria, is not the Gulf. But anyhow, I will try to give some specificities in the Arab world to show how political Islam is getting birth. Political Islam means the relation between Muslim groups and the state and the political regimes. Otherwise, why are we calling it political? But even the non-political Islam is indirectly political. If a regime concentrates on a ritualistic Islam, shying away from politics, it is enough to perform the rituals. This is political Islam, but returned upside down. That means the political regime is pushing Islam outside the political arena to be confined to ritualism, although Islam is not a ritualistic religion. Like Jesus, when Jesus came, he refused Jewish ritualism. He wanted to make Judaism something internal, something related to the heart, to the relation between man and God. Then the apolitical Islam may be, in a way, a political Islam, a dogmatic Islam, who is speaking all the time on the sex of the angels, on the creation, on eschatology. Well, how can we arrive to certitude in such metaphysical and transcendent topics? That may create dissent inside the Muslim community. A political regime is interested in making Islam a dogmatic Islam to shy away from politics. Then it is, although it is a political Islam, but it is political Islam upside down. All the dispute which you see in the mass media concerning the veil in England, in France, in Germany, good that the debate is not yet hectic in Canada. It is not a political issue. But in a way it is a political issue, because the veil is an indicator of an identity. That means certain community would like to say that we have an identity called Islamic, then we are against Westernization, we are against the imitation of the West, then it is a symbol of an Islam, a rejectionist Islam, whether in Europe or in Turkey or in Egypt or in any Arab and Muslim country, which is making the question of the veil a big issue, as if Islam is to have a veil or not to have a veil. Who has the real belief and who has not the belief? Who is a Muslim and who is not a Muslim? A quarrel which exists everywhere in the Muslim world. I am considered not a Muslim because I am not ritualistic, I am not formalistic, I am not entering in these transcendent issues and so on, but I am taking the side of the people, of the political struggle against dependency on USA. I am defending the rights of the poor. I am for the freedom of thinking. Then I am attacked because this is not Islam what I am doing, because I am not speaking on prayer, on the existence of God, on attacking secularism, on attacking people who are taking their knowledge and information from the West. There are two types of political Islam, as I said in the beginning. An angry Islam, rejectionist Islam, violent Islam, refusing dialogue, maybe using bombs. Let me explain to you why that type of Islam comes. I'm not justifying it or criticizing it, but just describing the phenomena. The angry Islam is the son or the daughter of the reformist movement. Since 200 years ago, we began our awakening, we began our reformist movement, like Martin Luther and John Calvin in the 15th century, 16th century. We had, since 200 years, our reformers. They participated very well in the national struggle against the British, the French, and all those who colonized the Muslim world. Those who fought for the independence of Algeria are the Islamic movements. Those who fought for the independence of Yemen are the Islamic movement. Those who fought against the British in Egypt and in Iraq are the Islamic movements. The Islamic movements in the 19th century and in the 20th century was the umbrella under which all fighters against colonialism worked. Nationalists, Marxist-Leninists, communists, liberals, Islam was a very wide umbrella under which all anti-colonial did work. Exactly like Marxism-Leninism in Vietnam and in Cuba. Those who fought in Vietnam against the French and then against the British were not only the Marxist-Leninists, were the nationalists and the liberals. Those who fought in Cuba against Batista, that was not only Marxist-Leninist, but it was only the umbrella. All those who made the Islamic Revolution of Iran, that was not only the Islamic movement, that was not only Khomeini, but the Marxist-Leninists, the Maoists, the liberals. Liberation movement of Bazargan, and Khomeini is only a symbol. That was the case of our reformist movement. It was the umbrella under which we fought colonialism. And we did succeed. All Arab and Muslim world got their independence thanks to these reformers four or five generations afterwards. In the name of jihad, in the name of the struggle against the occupier. And after we got our independence, those who ruled They ruled alone. They expelled the liberals, the Islamicists, the Marxist-Leninists. They expelled all those who were comrades in the battlefield, and they ruled alone. This is the destiny of the states in the post-colonial era in the Arab and the Muslim world, and surely in Egypt. Where these people would go? If they move, if they are active, they go to prison. So was the reformers, the Muslim groups, the Muslim brothers in Egypt. In 54, Nasser put them in jail with torture, without trial. 10 years, 15 years. I was young at that time. I did not participate violently against Nasser and for the re-establishment of democracy, but I was gathering, I was collecting aids for the families where their fathers and men were jailed. It was a humanistic work. That's why I was not being jailed. But anyhow, those who have been jailed, they stayed 10, 15, 20 years in prison with torture. Although they made the struggle against the British or against the French in North Africa, then they felt completely injustice. People felt that although they contributed in the national struggle against the colonial, other people got the fruit and they went to prison. Then another Islam began to be built in the psychology, in the mind, and so on, rejecting all type of secularism, secular ideologies, national, liberal, Marxist. They think that all this were antagonistic to Islam. Another new Islam has been built in prison, rightly, and after 20 years, when the state decided to be liberal, the state brought this out of prison, but the rancor and the anger stayed in the hearts. They have not been recruited in the political process. They stayed in the streets. They are not allowed in practicing any political action. Then they began to form their own cells, their own parties, their own movements, underground, overground, and this is the beginning of political Islam. Where to go after being left out of prison without being recruited in the political system? Even those who made what we call the Free Officers' Revolutions in Syria, in Egypt, in Syria in 49, in Egypt in 52, in Iraq in 58, in Libya in 69, in Yemen in 62, the free officers when they took power, the half of the free officers were Muslim brothers, like in Egypt. But they have been liquidated because the free officers wanted to monopolize power. They have been jailed. Although they made the revolution, but they have been jailed. Sometimes they have been introduced to court with unjust tribune. No defenders, no law. Everyone knew that this is only a certain kind of a theater to put the political opposition in prison. Then the angry Islam came out in the 70s, Islam of the rejected, Islam where the Muslims have been violated their human rights. We have a film in Egypt called They Made Me Criminal. And indeed, the political system made the Muslim brothers criminal. They did not recognize their struggle against the British or the French. They did not let them participate in building the nation state. They went into prison, and when they have been freed, they have been not allowed to participate in the political process. Then justly, the political Islam is a natural birth of the circumstances which existed all over the Arab world. Everyone was silent in the 50s and in the 60s because the rulers had a big national project, unifying the Arab world, Nasser, building a socialist regime, making planning, nationalizing foreign companies, Suez Canal, Egyptianizing foreign banks in 57, building the High Dam in 61. Then everyone in the 50s and the 60s was recruited in a big national project in the 50s and in the 60s. The same thing in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, and in Yemen. But once the 70s came, all these national projects began to collapse. Nasser died, and the impact of Nasser's death on Egypt and in the Arab world was so detrimental that there was an upside down in our politics, from anti-colonial to pro-colonial, from a socialist construction to a capitalist construction, from land reform to giving again land to the landlords, from public sector to help the poor to the private sector. Then there was a collapse in the 70s of the nation state. We were dependent on USA policy, the open door policy in economy, a huge process of westernization in the country, and a huge corruption from inside. Businessmen were ruling, a new class from the army, from the upper class has been formed, having power and wealth. And for the people, unemployment, poverty, lack of housing. Then, in the 70s and the 80s, till now, we are living a huge social crisis. Moreover, political oppression. You know, once you have that type of corruption, but you open a little bit the door for liberalizing the regime and the permission of political parties to express themselves freely, but plus the economic corruption, we have political oppression. One ruling party the elections are frauded and creating an opposition sold to the state just to complete the form of democracy. And in 79, Sadat went to Israel, to Jerusalem, in November. And after this Camp David agreement and peace agreement with Israel, in spite of the occupation of the West Bank, of the Golan Heights, of Jerusalem, of the settlement, Egypt took Sinai, demilitarized, that means Israel could take Sinai again in 24 hours. the defeat of 67 hit the pride of the country. Egypt made the slogan, Egypt come first. Jordan made the same slogan, Jordan comes first. Kuwait made the same slogan, Kuwait comes first. This is exactly what we are living now. Who is helping the Palestinians? No one. Everyone is ready to make peace with Israel, in spite of the occupation of the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and Jerusalem, in spite of the settlements. But they are afraid from a popular uprising. Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia made an act of states of moderation against Syria, Hezbollah, and Iran, who would like to continue the national struggle of the 50s and the 60s. After the aggression of Israel on Gaza, December 2008 and January 2009, no one moved, including Egypt. Egypt permitted lately the Israeli submarines to cross the Suez Canal to go and make some maneuvering in the entry of the Gulf against Iran. Jerusalem is completely Judaized. We lost the half of Palestine in 48 and the other half in 67. Egypt has been completely isolated from the Arab world. Egypt is participating in encircling Gaza with Israel. Over 1.5 million people without food, without medicine. The attack on Iraq by America has been made from military bases of America in Bahrain, in Qatar, in Saudi Arabia, by big military ships crossing Suez Canal. That made the angry Islam more angry. I imagine myself a youngster, a young man, 18 years old, 20 years old, and I have this scene in front of me. What should I do? And in my tradition, in the Islamic tradition, Islam is the savior. There is a moment of disaster which will come, a chaos which will come, and the elitist people will come and will save. Then every young, including one of my sons. I have two sons, one Islamicist, one Nasserist, and a daughter Marxist-Leninist. And so on. But they are making a dialogue. Then, who will to go? Then, surely he would go to the Islamic groups who is telling him and giving him the ideology of salvation, the eschatology, the hope of the future. It doesn't matter how, openly, underground, with social services, with attacking bombs, with suicide bombs, it doesn't matter how. But psychology, every Muslim, if he is young, is ready to answer positively to a Muslim call. They are reading an Islamic tradition which is conservative, because we are living now in the 15th century. We have behind us 15th century Islamic tradition. The first 400 years, we were pluralistic tradition. There was the rationalism, the textualist, there were many trends. There is no one monolithic Islam. But since 1,000 years, Islam began to be monolithic, conservatist, traditional, literalist, textualist. Then what the young are reading the classical, traditional Islam without any interpretation, without any form of using reason. Ibn Taymiyyah is an author of the 8th century Hijra, that means 15th century AD. He came also in the same circumstances after the Crusades and the Tatar and the Mongols, and he wanted to mobilize the Muslim world and so to make Islam a savior. Then they found in Ibn Taymiyyah a historical moment to be repeated again, and his disciple Ibn al-Qayyim. There were some money coming to reprint Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn al-Qayyim in a very cheap way. Everyone would can have the complete work of Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn al-Qayyim with little money. Then the ideology is ready. The socio-political circumstances are ready. And the youth, who are not yet corrupted, unemployed, university graduates, who has no future, they are ready. Then traditionalism began to be the world, the golden world. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and in Algeria, the Muslim movements began. In Algeria, because almost they lost their national struggle against the French, and the new regime is corrupted, as I described, and the new youth in Algeria did not know where to go. Then they made the underground movements, and they are struggling till now in the mountains and so on. In Egypt, the same. In Saudi Arabia, this is from where Osama bin Laden came, he also wanted to participate in saving the Muslim world. Some political Islamic trend, they wanted to hide themselves, not to go underground and using violence. Then they wanted to make their battle on the level of rituals, the veil, the beard, the dress, because all these are innocent indicators, but they have the power of mobilizing the masses. In Cairo University demonstrations of the Islamic groups, boys and girls, students, female and male, with huge white dresses, with huge hijabs, people with huge beards, I said, "What I am." But these indicators, these formal indicators, have the power of recruiting, the power of mobilizing the masses. That's why, as I said in the beginning, the battle of the hijab, although it is tribal, but it is a bomb in order that people would tell the political regime, "We are here. A hijab, a veil, is our national identity." And they had some slogans, very appealing slogans. Because we are living in a psyche of corruption, then their slogans were the application of the Islamic law. Because if socialism did not work, if capitalism did not work, if Marxism in Yemen and Syria did not work, what will work? We never tried to apply the Islamic law. Then they made the slogan, the application of the Islamic law, as a savior. in order to solve the problems of poverty, of unemployment, of oppression, of excommunications, and so on. This is the first slogan. Then the application of the, as you see in Somalia now, all those who are killing each other in Somalia, all of them are saying the application of Islamic law, and they are killing each other in the name of the application of Islamic law, because the slogan is very appealing. The rule of God. I don't want to be ruled by Mubarak, by Mahmoud Abbas, by King Abdullah. All are the same. Independence on USA and in corruption. I want to be ruled by God, who is a just ruler. Then the second slogan, the rule to God, is also very appealing, very liberating slogan. I see this in the students in the university. Once you say Al-Hakimiyya Lillah, the rule to God, that means thousands and thousands of young people would come and begin their demonstrations. If I have to put God in one hand and all Arab regimes in the other hand, the choice is very clear. The just against the unjust. Islam is the solution, the third slogan. Yes, because we tried many solutions. We tried colonialism, we tried socialism, we tried communism, we tried, but our status did not change. Our position became worse. Then Islam is the solution. We did not try Islam. And the fourth slogan, Islam is the alternative. Even if I have a successful regime in the name of liberalism or communism or Marxism, Islam is still a relevant alternative. Islam is the alternative. With these four slogans, they have won the public opinion. The rule of the law, the rule of God, Islam is the solution, Islam is the alternative. The secular opposition is too weak. I work with the secular opposition. But every political party is an apartment in downtown Cairo. If we call for a lecture, 100 people come. If we call for a demonstration in the university, 200 people come. The Islamists, they can bring 50,000 people on the campus. Then the secular opposition is too weak. Because they are secular. They did not depend their opposition on the mass culture. They did not bridge their opposition with the Islamists. Because there is a competition between both. The seculars saying that the Islamists are reactionaries, and the Islamists say the seculars are atheists. Then there is no cooperation between both in the name of a national front, in the name of a coalition, where the opposition can be unified against political regimes. The nationalists were responsible for the defeat of 67. The liberals were responsible for the high degree of westernization in our country. If you go to Cairo or to any Arab country, how many Western transliterated vocabularies are on the ads? Take away Pizza Hut, McDonald's. There is no Arabic word in the streets. All of them are Western transliterated vocabularies. The Marxists and Leninists are responsible for the high degree of atheism in the country. The people is Muslim. He has his Islamic culture. Then the youth found in Islam a rescue device by which they can save themselves. The poor classes found in Islam another savior, because God is just, God will never accept this polarity between wealth and poverty. Islam will give them their identity against sutranization. And the power of the Islamic groups, they have been able to mobilize the females. We have been criticized that the female is marginalized in our societies. But when you go to the Muslim groups, the female comes first in political struggle, in national services, in civil society. Then the female found also in the Muslim groups an opening for their ambitions. In order not to be long, in our society nowadays, there is a complete absence of dialogue between the political party, Islamists and secular, between the political parties and the state. The state is interested in preserving its power. The state is ruling the country by the Ministry of Interior, by the police. If you go to any campus in our universities, we will find thousands and thousands of policemen around it. We received a university rector, a foreigner, in our university, and then he asked us, "Are you at war?" Because he found hundreds of police cars around our campuses, waiting to hit any demonstrations which may come out of the campus. We are still living in a culture which thinks that the truth is one. From one side, if I am in the state, I am in the truth, and all the opposition are wrong. If I am in the opposition, I am right, and the state is wrong. If I am a secular, I am right, and the Islamists are wrong. If I am an Islamist, I am right, and the seculars are wrong. No one had the idea that there is something called perspective. The truth is a perspective. It is a human vision. Who can see the moon from all its sides? The moon can be seen from one side. If you go to the other side, you will see the other side of the moon. But we are the victim of the unilaterality of truth. That's why there is a deadlock concerning the dialogue. Whether the dialogue between the people and the state, or the dialogue between the different kind of the opposition. Everyone is thinking that he is an alternative power. The state has to go, and I come as an alternative power. And I, the Islamist, not the secular, or I, the secular, not the Islamist. Then it is a vicious circle. We don't have yet the idea of a national front, of a national coalition, of accepting pluralism on the theoretical level, but a national unity on a practical program. In the name of Islam, I can defend the poor. And in the name of Marxism, I can defend the poor. And in the name of liberals, I can defend the poor. Then, concerning the theoretical framework, we can be different. But concerning the practical program, we are unified. I'm working for this, but no one hears, no one obeys, because the problem is still here. He thinks that the truth is from one side, the state or the opposition. Everyone is taking the religious text as the only source of knowledge. But the religious text is ambiguous. It can be interpreted differently. And why not reality cannot be a source of knowledge? Why not human experience cannot be the source of knowledge? Then you are textualist. This situation gave the state the opportunity to decree exceptional laws, emergency laws, to control our civil liberties, to tell the West that here is the danger, the political Islam. Please help us against a common enemy, which is the political Islam. The political Islam is dangerous for us and is dangerous for you. Help us, support us in making these exceptional laws to control civil liberties. The actual regimes are better than the future possible Islamic regimes which may come. In any election, the student board election, the Islamists win almost 70-80% of the votes. Even in the political elections, in the national elections for the parliament, in spite of the fraud of the state, and in spite of all the control of the state, the Muslim Brothers took 25% in the parliament. Imagine if there is any free election. Then the regimes are telling the West, please support us. Don't criticize us, because the alternative is worse. These people will come and they are very anti-Western and so on. The state never legalized political Islam, never entered in a dialogue with them, never accepted any political pluralism, based its rule on the fraud of election. That's why the youth are coming more and more to the Muslim groups. People flee to the Islamic groups, seeing in the political Islam a savior, as in the old days mysticism was the savior for the oppressed people. Let me finish by saying the following. There are many kinds of political Islam. Let me speak of the second kind, which is the liberal Islam, the enlightened Islam, the democratic Islam, the social Islam, the liberal Islam, the socialist Islam, the nationalist Islam. I received a secret declaration last week by mail, very good written, and signed by Muslim Marxists. And I said, well, this is also a new type of political Islam, that combining Islam and Marxism. I, 30, 40 years ago, I founded the Islamic Left. How to make a new political culture based on Islam as the culture of the people, but in the same time making Islam a carrier for social demands, making Islam for justice, equality, freedom, instead of using Islam by the reactionaries and the conservatives against the rights of the people. But the Islamic Left has been accused by the Islamists as Marxists. It has been accused by the Marxists as fundamentalists. It has been accused by the state as communist Muslim Brothers. Then you cannot still work for a new direction to combine the political Islam in its two wings, the tradition and modernity. I'm doing this on the popular level. I'm doing this academically in my academic writings. No one is recognizing this new type of Islam, even in the West. How many books, articles have been written on terrorism, fundamentalism, political Islam in the West? Who wrote on the enlightened Islam, on the liberal Islam? Although they exist, they have their writings, but the West is not interested, because the West cannot shoot at the liberal Islam as he can shoot at terrorist Islam. exist in Tunis, 1421 group, in Morocco, Justice and Equality, in Egypt, in Algeria, in Iran, Ali Shariati, which is not recognized neither by the revolution nor by the Marxists. In Indonesia, they call it the watermelon Islam, because it is green from outside, red from inside. The term justice and equality is everywhere, in Morocco, in Darfur, Sudan, and in Turkey. We oppose, but peacefully, without using violence, because we know the power of reason, the power of statistics. We accept dialogue. And it is very difficult to reject it, neither from the state nor from the opposition. We have been accused of being an elite, intellectual elite, who does not know how to mobilize the masses. We are not in the mass media, as the terrorists are, because of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Extremism is the information in the mass media. Bad news are news. Good news are not new. It is easy to struggle with the extremes. But with the center, what are you going to say? My last word is the following. I hope that one day the West will not put the Islamic, political Islam, in one basket. There are at least two big trends. I hope one day that the West also, in case that he studies the enlightened Islam, he doesn't say that it is the implementation of the Western culture. It is Voltaire, Rousseau, Montesquieu. As if we cannot create anything new without being influenced by Western writers. We have been accused that we are a cultural phenomenon, not a political phenomenon. But why not a political culture phenomenon? The lady who took the Bastille in the French Revolution, her mind has been worked by the ideas of Voltaire and Rousseau. Without Voltaire, Rousseau and Montesquieu, no one could have taken the Bastille. Then we have to go through a process of rebuilding our tradition as a political culture. That's why I work a lot in liberation theology. Because without making a liberation theology or a theology of liberation, people will be split into two types of culture, traditionalism and secularism. And everyone is rejecting the other. As far as the socio-political situations are as they are, we will have the situation I described. Lack of democracy, dependency on the West, the social crisis, corruption is getting more and more. Then the solution is to liberalize our regime, to democratize, to recognize the political Islam as a legal party, to enter in the process of dialogue with other parties, to enter in a process, a democratic process, and enter in the parliament, in order that we can have a healthy phenomena, instead of having an unhealthy phenomena, people who are ready to explode, to bomb themselves, in order to realize a cause. We have to fight for a national front. Pluralism on the theoretical level and a national program on the practical level. If we can change the political Islam from within, if we can change their conservative tone and make them practically, not using violence but dialogue, I think we can hope for a political Islam which can be a friend inside and a friend outside. Thank you very much.
Well, that was pristine. Really lovely to hear you. So who would like to step into this? Raise issues, themes, things you'd like clarified, things you'd like to probe. Please.
Professor, it sounds from your presentation as if Islamicism is mostly a youth movement.
And what?
It's mostly a movement of the youth.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Today, as is the case in the West, as they grow older, tend to become less radicalized.
May I just repeat the question for the sake of our recording?
Yeah.
Our colleague has suggested that it sounds like the political Islam is largely a youth movement, and he's wondering if people in your country and in much of the Arab world are like so many in Canada. That is, they're radicals in the 60s and they drive SUVs in 2000.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, once you are supported by your papa, once you are still a student learning, educating yourself, trying to find for you a horizon for action. Yes. Once you are getting older, having a good job, or immigrating abroad to Canada or to USA and having a nice salary, married, having children, Islamic commitment may appear as a nice memory.
But is the, just to follow up on it, if I may, you also talked about the social disintegration and a whole range of other things. Has that, as our colleague I think is querying, has that meant that the fervor of youth continues for a longer period of time, that people are much more concerned? Or is this largely, I mean, not to in any sense diminish the profound issues involved, but it also has something, does it not, with the extraordinary demographic shift in much of the Arab world, where you have so many, such a high percentage of the community is young.
Yeah. Those who are less than 20 years, they are 40% of our society.
In Egypt?
In Egypt, yes. And those who are facing the social crisis are the teenagers. Well, I am also a Muslim activist, but with the pencil.
Yeah.
Writing. I don't demonstrate. But not everyone is using his pencil. I have my position, I have my family, I have my children, I have my grandchildren, and so on. Then I am established. But once you are getting older, and I'm not saying not all, but the majority are socially recruited in a way or in another. There are some who are still fighting from the old generation and so on, but they are not too much.
Mm-hmm. You want to pursue that at all, or are you satisfied? Please. Ian.
Now, you mentioned at one point that for 1,500 years of Islamic history, there was a 400-year period that was pluralistic, and that somehow that broke down into an increasing set of rival claims for monism, or something like that. We have an interesting parallel in contemporary Western politics, where in some respects, liberalism is setting itself up in certain ways as also as monistic. So it's increasingly non-pluralistic. by using the language of pluralism. Could you comment on what it was that vanished after that 400-year period of pluralism that took it in the direction of monism?
I will answer you as a philosopher, not as a historian. Using some terminology of Bergson, élan vital, that means this vital push in history and human beings and so on. It has a time limitation. Pluralism cannot go forever. Pluralism is a reaction against monolithism, but itself would fall again into unilateralism, till another movement, a pluralistic movement. Then again, there is no permanent political culture which crosses all types, all cycles of history, all times, and so on. Then it is a cyclic thing. I wonder, in the case of the West, in the beginning of modern times, since the 14th century and the Reformation in the 15th and the Renaissance in the 16th, and then the rationalism, Descartes and Spinoza in the 17th century. They defended the freedom of thinking. They defended cogito ergo sum. They defended the rights of man in the French Revolution in the 18th century and so on. But if you see now, where is reason? Lukács will say the destruction of reason. Now, reason is no more the point of departure. Neither in postmodernism, nor in deconstructionism, nor in the contemporary trends, then reason has its limitation from the 17th century till maybe the 20th century and ended. Then this is the crisis in the Western philosophy nowadays. Where to go? You destroyed what you have built. You destroyed reason, the human being, maybe freedom for the sake of globalization, the criteria of 1-0, as Roland Barthes would say, de la grammatologie, as Derrida would say, that means thinking, that means units of writing. Then in the West there is a big crisis. How can you begin a new point of departure after cogito ergo sum?
Go on, Ed.
It was just fascinating, the resonances between what you're describing in Islam and contemporary theorists of liberalism, for example, John Gray in England, who says that the big temptation, there's always been two streams of liberal thought. One that's towards convergence, often implicit, the idea that tolerance is a way station until we get to mutual agreement by everything. He says that the second is modus vivendi, how we live together despite disagreement. And he says that the future of liberalism depends upon rejecting the first notion of convergence and accepting modus vivendi, which of course is the essence of pluralism that you're describing. You mentioned Bergson. Well, one of his great students, Maritain, came up with the idea of atheistic theocracy. So, in a way, we're talking about anthropological realities that seem to transcend periods of history, religious frameworks even, and are rooted in some human tendency to avoid diversity and move towards unifocal affirmation at the point of a gun.
Yeah. Some things that John Rawls, with his theory of justice, trying to bring liberalism with socialism, is a new point of departure. That's why John Rawls is very popular in universities, in dissertations, and so on, concerning a new opening. But, you know, for us in the third world, finding a third way between Marxism or communism from one side and liberalism or capitalism from the other side, this is very common. We tried in the third world in the 50s and the 60s having the third way between both, defending the public sector without falling into communism, and defending some private sector without falling into capitalism. This is what John Rawls is trying to do. But anyhow, it is too little. It is not like cogito ergo sum. It is not like the big point of departure which began in the 17th century.
Ibrahim.
I found your talk very interesting and challenging in many ways. Someone like me who has studied the Islamic movement for a long time. But it seems to me that the major gap in the talk has been the absence of any discussion of the relationship between, let's say, the Gulf states and the Islamic movement in Egypt. Because that relationship, since at least the 1950s, has been a very strong relationship. That's to say, many Islamists were expelled, or they went to the Gulf, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, whatever. And what they found there was a conservative regime on the outside, in terms of Islamic values, but a tribal regime in essence. And in many ways, one could argue that there has been a tacit alliance between a number of Islamists and tribalism in the Gulf. And that alliance has shifted after the Sadat regime came to power in 1970 to the Egyptian intellectual and religious landscape. Could you please elaborate on this? Because
yeah.
It seems to me that this is very significant.
Yeah, this is true. Some, in order to flee the situation...
My colleague Ibrahim only speaks the truth.
Yeah.
He's
as perspective.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true that some, I can mention names, they went to the Gulf. And instead of making an active political Islam, in the name of Islam, for this new political situation in the Gulf, because they will be kicked out, they began to readjust their political Islam according to the circumstances of the Gulf, not criticizing the Emirates, not criticizing the political regime, not criticizing the huge degree of consumption, not criticizing the huge degree of wealth, not criticizing the presence of the Asians who have no rights coming from India and Pakistan and so on in the Gulf area, not criticizing their willing for alliance with Israel, and even making some political opinion to please the emirs, like legitimizing the temporary marriage. Not criticizing the military bases. I don't know if this is more a political Islam, because a political Islam is a committed struggle Islam, national Islam, but here you are selling yourself to the political regime, you are defending a regime, you are readjusting regime as the political regime would like.
That's
so actually, I was going to follow up on the
yeah,
relationship
please.
Between somebody like Bin Laden, who, as you said, came from Saudi Arabia, and the Lahiri, who came from the context of Jihad in Egypt, and the alliance between the Lahiri and Bin Laden, which seems to me to be similar or parallel to the alliance between certain Islamist personalities in the Gulf and the tribal regimes of the Gulf. Except that Bin Laden's alliance is much more radical in nature than the one between the Islamists and the tribal regimes in the Gulf.
Yeah, well, but still, Bin Laden and Zawahiri, they have a case. The presence, the over-presence of America all over the world. In Iraq, in Afghanistan, they have a case. They treat it wrongly, rightly, this is not the issue, but they have a case. But those old Muslim brothers who lived in the Gulf, they have no more a case. They are no more freedom fighters. They are no more struggling. It is a very docile Islam sold to the political regime.
And they're on the side of consumerism.
And on the side of consumerism.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Such a world. One more. Please.
Mr. Hanafi, I would like to ask that you elaborate on your statement that when you said, I am not ritualistic, because I have asked practically the same question to Muhammad Arkoum.
Mm-hmm.
And Because he kept deconstructing everything, and I asked him, you know, where do you stand ultimately?
Professor Abuswai asked about some clarification on the statement that I'm not ritualistic. So where do you stand on that?
Philosophers are eager to look for essence of things. David, isn't that true?
We do.
A classical philosopher.
We convince ourselves we find it at times too. Yeah. Or at least we smell it.
Yeah. When Jesus said, I did not come to abolish the law, but to make it more perfect. Mm-hmm. When Jesus entered the temple and threw all these merchants and so on, you have made the house of the Lord a supermarket. When Jesus says that love thy neighbor, this is the essence of things. Because he found that the Jews have exaggerated in the law of Moses till it became a formal law, void from any spirituality. The Essenians were in the same. Then I am a reaction against all these Islamic practices who fight till the end for a beard, for a scarf, for a jilaba. And leaving the American bases, leaving the American invasion in Iraq, leaving the Palestinian issue, leaving the poverty, then I enter Islam from the open door, not from the narrow door. That doesn't mean that I'm minimizing rituals. But I would like, you know, sometimes I imagine myself in front of God in the last judgment and asking me, Professor Hanafi, I gave you knowledge, I gave you courage, I gave you whatever. Why did you confine yourself in rituals? Why did you not criticize the American bases, defend the rights of the poor, defend the freedom of the people? What should I say?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I don't want to use text. But we have many texts that 1 hour learning is better than 70 years praying. There are people who are praying and who had nothing from the prayer except their body movements, because they don't have piety. There are hundreds who are fasting and they have nothing from fasting, that means feeling the poverty of the poor, except being hungry. Then I am like Jesus against the rabbis.
More of that to come. We will now go downstairs where there will be a little light, a bit to eat, and for a half an hour or so, and then into C014 for the rest of our time. So thank you very much.
That's all right.